Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. Once again, we have Madison Smart Bell in the studio. He's written so many books, I can't list them all, but we first met him, of course, with All Souls Rising, the first of a trilogy about the Haitian Revolution. He's written so many books. I think we've interviewed him for almost all the books he's written, at least since the days of All Souls Rising. His latest is very different, very interesting. It's called The Color of Night. And Madison Smart Bell, there you are, am here.
I see you got your mojo working.
I got it working.
Well, one difference about this book is that it's short.
And reads quickly.
It's good for plane ride, you know, for the flight's not too long. A quick flip, as a commercial writer once told me, but I think it kind of stays with you. But I kind of wore myself out writing these epic novels, and I really wanted to do something.
The Haitian trilogy was how many pages altogether?
Like 2,222 or something. That's about right.
It was great though, but it was long.
Yeah, I mean they came in sort of 800-page packages, but you know there was. I like books like that. I like War and Peace, for example, longer than any individual volume. You know, you get to be in that world for a long time. But I do think there's less and less audience for, you know, now the way things are going, we're more into books that you can write and read on a cell phone, you know. So that wasn't part of my motive, but I thought, you know, something that's just not like Monster Long would be nice. And I've always admired this wonderful sort of short, quick cutting book by Joan Didion called Play It As It Lays, where there's not a chapter in it that's more than a double page spread, and a lot of them are shorter than that. I'd really like to write a book like that someday.
So that inspired you the way you wrote this?
For style. I thought that was, you know, that was the style idea.
Given all the other books that I've read that you've written, it was clear that The Color of Night, you wrote in a very different way. I mean, the other books you had to steep yourself in, let's say, in Creole and history and a place completely. Not that you didn't do that in here, but in a different fashion.
Well, this book is mostly white space in a way. There's a guy told me a long time ago, maybe in William Gilman's book, I'm not sure, but it's a sort of koan of screenwriting. A good screenplay is mostly white space.
What does white space mean?
White space is the stuff with no words on it.
Right. I figured that, but I was just trying to clarify.
I also had a student recently who was actually trying to sort of sculpt white space, you know, so that he would be making a visual artifact too. Well, I didn't get into that. I mean, Peter Matheson has done that, but my point there, I mean, in screenwriting, it's because, you know, good screenplays aren't overdetermined because you don't know who's going to be playing the parts, basically.
Right.
And, you know, you want to have a lot of leeway there. That's the point of it there. But here, the point for me was much of the interest of this book is about what's not being said. And, you know, the statements are extremely kind of clipped and partially repressed or just really quick and cutting. And it's not as your narrator's not shy or anything like that. But
May is not shy.
But, you know, she's not going to tell you anything twice.
She's not. This book, though, it made me think of I was going to say at some levels it's darker, but that's too simplistic to say it's darker than.
I think most people would say that, though.
It's got the but you were in a certain place when you were writing this book. This is something that was driving from the inside out in a different way than the other things I've read. In other words, what do I mean by that? I mean that you write in the beginning of the book about your daemon.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, so now after I read that little piece in the beginning, I read the book, something was driving you in this book. There's something in your heart gut that had to come out.
Well, actually, I don't.
Too much?
The ways that we're used to thinking about it in the late 20th and early 21st century, you have to be right, you know. But I don't. That's not really the way I experienced the world. I feel more like it was an outside force, curiously.
Uh-huh.
and just something that passed through me to express itself without very much intervention for me at all.
I understand that.
In a certain way, I know that I consciously shaped and crafted it a little bit, but it was – so I was actually writing a more kind of research, craft-demanding novel, Devil's Dream, about Bedford Forrest at the same time. I finished them around the same time. I started this one later, but it was an utterly different experience of writing. I mean, the Forrest thing, I depend a lot on being able to hear the voice of the character in my head always, but with Forrest, it had to be conjured, you know, for everybody. And here it was like, nope, somebody else is doing the conjuring here. It just came right through, and it's like I'm taking dictation from this character, May.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. The last person I talked to the last author I spoke with who I've gotten to like a great deal, who said something very similar about her work, was Leslie Marmon Silko.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah.
She's Laguna Pueblo. She was from
that. Right, that makes me want to read her work. I just sort of vaguely know who she is.
Well, when I interviewed her, I said, you know, I had a lot of dreams reading your book, and I had dreams reading your book, too. And she said, that's good. Because she talked about, didn't call him Damon, but she talked about a force from the outside kind of driving this thing and pushing. And this is, I mean, even from your days when you were doing the Haitian stuff, now, you know, you've never really left that. It's always been – it's part of your soul since you were
born. Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
And there's a part of that outside, we have no complete control, but we have some control. And that relationship between the two forces, that's in this work, and that's kind of what you're talking about.
Well, what this book is supposed to draw on is archetypes, not so much out of Greek mythology, although it's related to that, but out of the ancient mystery cults that were religious practices that kind of revolved around certain aspects of divinities formed out of the Greek pantheon. And in this case, it's Dionysus. So you can model that back over to any kind of, you know, Vedic possession-driven cult. Like Haitian voodoo or Pentecostal churches in this country, where something takes you over completely and occupies your body. I mean, this is what maenads were in the classical.
May is a maenad.
Yeah, it's a little cheap. You know, I just got a little joke out of it, spelling your name, that M-A-E, you know. So it's just sort of, but it seems kind of sweet and nice. You think of a woman named May, you know, you're not thinking of somebody.
My daughter's name.
Edgy.
Maisie.
Yeah, Maisie. You sort of go in that direction with that. Right, right. You don't get the other syllable where she does. I came to think that I'd wanted to do something that had that element in it. That was a very early idea that was in the back of my mind, and I really had forgotten about it for a while. And something else popped up and made me think of it. And at that point, I had a new piece. I was going to situate it within 70s terrorism, I think, sort of late 60s, early 70s terrorism. And then I thought, you know, I put May in a situation that's sort of like the Manson family. And I think that I went and reread the stuff that I'd read before about that, which is extremely scary, I'm here to tell you again.
It is scary.
I mean, you forget how scary that was. For a guy who only actually killed, what, you know, I mean, less than 10% of people get killed in car wrecks every day in the United States. I mean, he really made a big impression because of, you know, the style of it. But yeah, you start reading about the way that community worked, and I think it was very purely a Dionysian cult, a mystery cult, where he's the god, he's the Dionysus figure, and the followers are mostly women, lose themselves in a kind of frenzy, the same kind of stuff that you read about in the Bacchantes by Euripides, where the ladies go so crazy they rip their own son to pieces at a certain point.
Right.
Yeah.
And they killed many others in Greek mythology and Greek history.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's a bloody business. we forget that, too.
It's a bloody business. And his existence is a bloody business. This, in some ways, I mean, it was as if – well, clearly a couple of things here in my head. One is that when you talked about the late 60s and Manson, the period, it was you're connecting that to 9/11.
Well, yeah. I mean, I didn't really – that just seemed automatic to me. But it kind of came clear to me in talking to a journalist the other day. Having said the thing about how impressive it was that Manson could, you know, frighten everybody so much with such a small number of actual murders. The next thing that was really like that was 9/11. I mean, you know, you do all this. You start with a little bit of planning and a couple of box cutters, and take down four planes. That's not huge. I mean, they don't. That, maybe for you know, for one day, that's kind of a lot. But planes crash. We used to have hijacking, this and that. But there was something, you know, that like really, really frightened people for a while. And you know, in between, I don't see anything else quite like that. And certainly for me, the character, it's like, well, boy, I never felt so, you know, pardon the expression, turned on since, you know, since the 60s when I was doing these cult murders for my cult.
Right. I mean, there have been things like Jonestown and stuff like that occurred kind of.
Oh, I don't. Jonestown's not the same. I don't.
How's it different?
Well, first of all, it's that's hypnotizing people to kill themselves, not kill other people. To me, that difference is huge. Oh, well, they whacked a couple of people who invaded their perimeter, but they weren't out, you know, predating in the way that the Manson people were, and they weren't turning planes into missiles to, you know, fly into major installations the way Al Qaeda was, and would happily do again, I think.
When we talked about it earlier, I mean, one of the things that when you talk about Pentecostal churches and you talk about this, the Manson cult, even though they're not the same, those forces that drive us to follow are very real. I mean, we like to condemn them a lot. Oh, I would never do that. I'm not part of this. I couldn't be part of any of that stuff. It's just not me. But that's part of who we are as a species, and it happens naturally. This is not something that is just out there in some fringe.
Well, my model for a lot of these things is hypnosis, actually. I mean, some people are more susceptible to being hypnotized. Almost everybody can be hypnotized a little bit, at least. And maybe 10% of all people just really don't respond to hypnosis at all. And then the other 10% at the other end of the spectrum are people who can be turned into chickens. And stage hypnotists who, you know, entertain people with that know how to recognize the 10% that can go much further than the average group in the middle, that can be relaxed and sort of understand that they're in an altered state. And, you know, you can do some therapy with them and maybe make them remember, quit smoking or remember where they put their keys. But you know, they're not gonna fly for you or anything like that. And cult leaders, I think, are able to pick the talented 10th too, or just draw them. So that, I think, is, you know, what you see going on in a lot of these situations, that there are people who are susceptible, and that you get a whole community that's built out of people who have this odd talent for being controlled by somebody else, frankly. I mean, mm-hmm. to put it brutally.
Well, what I thought about was, there's a couple of things. One is something you wrote in the beginning of your book, which I want to touch base with, because I think it's this. You gave us the subtext before you even started, in some ways. One of the subtexts of the book is in the beginning of your book. But the other is, you know, I mean, there is this thing about how human beings can end up following things, whether it's a lynch mob.
Yeah, or, you know, it's funny. You know, I was just reading Strange Fruit the other day, which I had never read before, strangely, and it's an awfully good book, 1944, Lillian Smith. I just couldn't believe just literarily how good it was, but her lynch mob scene is scary, peculiarly scary, because you see it coming, it's right at the end, but she doesn't actually do it. It's skipped. You get somebody who's trying to stop it, two guys who like to stop it running right up to the edge of the crowd, and then it cuts, and you have people reacting to it afterwards. This is a very Greek kind of thing to do, actually. But all of it's about – all of the reflection about it afterwards is about the compulsion that it had. And for the most part, it's other people thinking about what is this compulsion of people. It's exactly your question to, you know, be caught up in a mob and do unthinkable things. And you know, right. For most people, if you didn't have a mob, you wouldn't do the unthinkable thing. You wouldn't even imagine it.
But again, this is one of those books that makes you think about that all humankind is capable of doing the unthinkable thing.
Right. Even, I mean, that's the thing about May. I mean, she's, whatever her virtues may be, you have to say she's a murderer. She takes pleasure in killing other people from time to time. And she's, by normative standards, crazy in the sense that she believes that she is justified in everything she does because she's actually not a mortal being. She has, via human sacrifice, made herself into a god. And I think the book is set up so that you can spend the whole book in her world if you want, and that's certainly what she would like. I mean, it invites you to say this is reality. What I'm telling you is reality, and you know what you would otherwise be inclined to think. You know, the sort of pathological interpretation of this is incorrect and irrelevant, and it's so the reader has a choice there, whether they want to say, okay, there's more work goes on that people know about. You know, here's a sort of divine figure out of Greek mythology is walking among us, wreaking havoc in a way that, you know, makes moral sense to her but not to us. Or you can say this is the reviews are starting to come out saying this. I mean, it's a permissible reading. This is a book that shows how violence evolves from victimhood. Now, you can certainly make that case. May would really hate that, though.
She hates that. That's what she thought of her.
She won't be a victim. That's if, right. If you look for a likable thing in her, it's that. She refuses. Anybody else would say she has been a victim in many ways as well as a perpetrator. And, you know, that explains it all, blah, blah. But she, unlike most people in that situation, says, nope, I'm not having that. I refuse to have that be any part of the way I see myself.
She admonishes another character in the book for being just that.
Yeah. Someone she never liked much. Anyway.
She didn't like her. She didn't like that person from the beginning. But in the beginning, there's a piece, Iris Murdoch, that you have in here. About Ate. Did I say that right? Ate?
That's how I say it.
Ate, yes. I'll just read it. I want to read this because I mean, I think it has a lot to
go
do
for
with
it.
The book. Forgive is too weak a word. Recall the idea of ate, which was so real to the Greeks. Ate is the name of the almost automatic transfer of suffering from one being to another. Power is a form of ate. The victims of power, and any power has its victims, are themselves infected. They have then to pass it on, to use the power on others.
I read – well, one thing about that is I tried to do some independent research on the – Greek figure of Ate, and I couldn't get any statement quite like that. I think Murdoch's read is a little bit special, but it was perfect for what I was doing. I'd read lots and lots of Iris Murdoch starting in my middle teens and on through my 20s. I might have even read most of her books and some of them many times over. And I was maybe halfway through this book, Color of Night, when I happened to read a novel of hers called The Unicorn that has this passage in it. And it seemed so perfect for my character that I pulled it for an epigraph, and And then, too, I was just thinking in general, I mean, that there was – if I hadn't happened to pick up the Murdoch book, I wouldn't have thought of the influence of her work on this book. But there is some. I mean, one of her talents, which is pretty unusual, I think, is to, in the writing of a novel, make, you know, kind of difficult, abstract, often kind of complicated philosophical ideas be sexy. You know, she was really good at that.
Yeah.
And not by dressing them up or anything, she would find that the sort of eroticism that was actually there in the ideas and bring it out, because ideas were erotic to her. She was a philosopher.
Right.
But
right.
I thought there's something in common there between those two projects. I mean, this book is a love story. I'm going to insist. I mean, it's a very strange one, but it's an authentic love story, among other things.
It is a love story. May and Laurel.
Yeah.
It's a powerful love story that is part of this text. And you write, when she was at one point in the book, she was musing on whether, looking at Laurel and musing about her and thinking about what had just happened, and said about talking about the place where pain and pleasure are one.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to read this? Want me to read it?
Why don't you do it?
Okay, because you have such a unique reading voice there. Just suffer, I said inside my mind. Don't try to make anything of your suffering. Was I talking to Laurel? Or myself, or to O. There was a point where I differed from them. That had been O's big mistake, to believe that suffering could be redeemed instead of polluted by such a transformation.
I'm not even going to claim to understand that, but that's the heart of the. But this is what I mean. This is like this character is talking to and through me. Uh-huh. I didn't generate that idea. Actually, I'm over there with O, who's for Orpheus.
Orpheus, right?
Who plays a role in the is 20th century analog is in the book, being, you know, late 60s rock musician first of all, I'd already written that when I found the recorded it, shall we say, when I found the Ate quote. And they fit together so perfectly. It's like, you know, synchronicity, things started coming together. But really, you look at me in my life, I believe in sublimation. Even this book is sublimation.
Mm-hmm.
And I basically, you know, in my musical career, I'm a blues musician. That's all about taking suffering and making it into art so that, you know, and in the process making your suffering, alleviating the suffering by doing something with it. And so... Yeah, it's a very kind of alien idea for me that somebody would come along and completely reject that. But that's just who she is.
So then why did you have to listen to her and write this?
I can't answer that. Well, I can in a way. I mean, I think in possession, of which I have limited experience, but very strong limited experience, you get after it's very scary in the beginning, or at least for the first time. For me, it was only a first time that where it was like complete and very strong, and that's absolutely utterly bone frightening. But afterwards,
mm-hmm.
You've had a big catharsis, and you feel, you know, like the whole inside of your psyche has been cleaned with fire. And
apt description with this woman.
Well, right, exactly. But again, you know, this isn't like there's no monopoly on this kind of stuff. I mean, I'm sure, and indeed I've read things, a wonderful book by Dennis Covington called Salvation at Sand Mountain that describes a very, very similar experience in the snake handling churches firsthand. And that's the attraction, I think. The people go for the catharsis. And here's the morally questionable part. For me, writing this book, I don't think anybody reading this book would feel encouraged to go out and murder people or try to blow up big buildings.
No.
It somehow doesn't do that.
No, it doesn't do that.
I'm not sure why not, though, because But somehow the feel of it is not that, even though you've got somebody enthusiastically doing it. You do feel in some way or another that you're reading a tragedy, I think. So it doesn't – it's not inciting people to commit crimes. But so – I mean, if it was, that would be very difficult for me to say – for me to justify not worrying about the content of the thing that was giving me the catharsis by going through me. You know, right. I think it's morally questionable anyway. I mean, if you're going to – court possession, which is a form of inspiration, actually. I mean, most people don't have it, you know, or don't construct it in such a kind of absolute way. Nor, for me, does it normally occur in such an absolute way, where it's really like, okay, there's another entity that's, you know, like William Yeats and the, or James Merrill and the Ouija board and automatic writing and, you know, whatever. The Oracle of Delphi, you pick it. I don't want to say I'm on that level, but structurally the experience I think is the same. And so it does seem to me morally questionable not to examine, you know, or have more of a gateway to say exactly what sort of thing are you going to permit to go through the channel that you're opening. The problem is it's just the catharsis itself is so desirable that that's not the – I don't think that way. And I think people who practice this kind of thing religiously are inclined not to either. And they're, you know, in a structured setting where they – it's more predictable what's going to come. But is this getting too weird?
No. Because what I'm thinking about here we have this – no, Laurel. I mean you created these characters – there's a lot in here that really relates to this the story of Bacchus Dionysus, the Maenades, the Greek story is the essence of the story. But it's also the tortured nature of May, as I kept reading it. Because the way you structure this book is going back and forth. Pardon me, in time. And then even gets more complex back and forth in time towards the end of the book. But you go back and forth in time to, I guess, basically three different settings. And so you see this woman who's become this blackjack dealer living in this place. You don't know a lot about – I mean, you very carefully unfold this thing for the reader to kind of get to a place. Because I always wondered throughout the novel, how did she get to where she? How come she's still there? Everything gets revealed as we go. But what she went through with her brother, Terrell, being raped and by her own brother over the years, and then seeing what she became. I mean, there's that element of the book too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is a very. I mean, it made me think of Ate, that, you know, that once you've been abused by power, you often end up abusing.
Well, yeah, of course. Others. I mean, that's like built into sociology and psychology of our time. It's no longer has any religious dimension. I'm not even saying that it should for ordinary life in our society. But what she has done is invested it with religious meaning. And it's the kind of religious meaning that the Greeks would have applied to it. You know, so it's not – and that's how she is able to say instead of – you know, I was terribly victimized by my brother for all these years. She tells herself instead that he was hardening her for entrance into immortality and all of that. I mean, there are many opportunities to consider that – this is a delusion on her part. And yet, for me, I'm sitting on the fence, you know, because I'm her voice. I'm just communicating her voice like the microphone here in the studio is carrying her voice. And so in order to be able to tell her story properly, I have to accept what she says.
But it also explains what happens beneath her.
Beneath her?
Yeah, what pushed her. What made her what brought her to the place she's in? You know? But then again, when you look at Laurel, since we don't know a lot about what brought her to the place she was in, which was a similar place.
Well, you get there are hints that she comes from a somewhat more privileged background,
right.
But at the same time, there are also some hints that she's had, you know, some of the same bad experiences that unfortunately are available to young women, and that she and May have that in common, and that's all very kind of oblique, you know. But so there's a period when they're young and they're together and they're inside this cult together and they're each other's sort of closest partner inside the cult that May at least believes that Laurel has adopted May's worldview, and maybe as far as the reader or even me, you know, it's like you can't really know to what extent that would have been true. But given some of the stuff that Laurel does with May, you kind of think, yes, she went pretty far in that direction, actually. But then when, you know, it gets to be 30 years later and they're, you know, they're seeing each other in these – having spent that time in vastly different circumstances, you sense that Laurel, whatever she thought at the time, has decided this was all just a game. You know, it's like this is upsetting to me, obviously, her whole life and every way that she gets meaning in her life is being, you know, shut down by Laurel. Yes, I remember that game we used to play, but it was kind of destructive, actually. I don't want to, you know, think about it anymore.
Right, which is one way of handling what you do when it's horrendous. You know, and what you were saying earlier though, about the characters, one of the things that I learned in these years of work and listening to women and doing the research on my shows over the years is that it made me think of it as I was reading this book, that more women than not have been either raped, molested, or some way sexually abused.
I hate thinking about that, but it's something we know. I really hate thinking about it, but
I don't like thinking about either. But it made me think of that.
No, it's. I mean, we're not talking about freaks here or
no
exceptions,
right?
I mean, this is the whole problem with Freud to begin with. I mean, when he began to hear these stories about incest and his treatment of hysterical women. He assumed, as anyone would have at the time, this can't be true. So the given is these stories can't be true. You know, fathers and brothers are not having sex with these young women. It never happened. So the whole question becomes, why did they imagine that it did?
Right.
And that actually controls, you know, the therapeutic practice for 75 years.
Right, right.
Pretty scary. I mean, you know, May's delusions, if that's what they are compared to that, are at least sort of straightforward. I mean,
I mean, it. Part of the book is also almost makes you feel the normalcy, if there's such a word, of abnormality, of what we call abnormality.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, you know, we're not going toward are we going toward the snowflake idea here, or the idea that there's. I think what you're driving at is something that the book really is about too. Is that there's more of the worst of human capability in everyone than everyone is prepared to accept or address, whether in terms of things that has been done to you or done by you or both.
Once again, we have Madison Smart Bell in the studio. He's written so many books, I can't list them all. His latest is called The Color of Night. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. Once again, we have Madison Smart Bell in the studio. He's written so many books, I can't list them all. His latest, it's called The Color of Night. The sojourn you take us through. I mean, you knew from when you start the book, it's not giving away. When you start the book, you know that this character, D, blank, blank, the line, you know who he is. I mean, it doesn't take long to figure out.
Well, there's a stuff on the cover that sort of threw that out there, I think. But I don't know. There's similarities. I mean, it's not exactly the same.
No, it's not exactly the same. But
you know, my interest became – I sort of went through the idea of Manson family as such and – more like through thinking, hey, this really was a mystery cult with all of the whole way it functioned is that. I mean, I'm just really writing about a mystery cult in that time and place that could produce these things.
Which they did produce. Why did you choose to do the D and the O and the line? When you came to their names instead of saying their names, what was that?
Well, I wanted... I started out with some kind of other sort of alias type thing for D, and then I thought if I just do D, that will help people make the Dionysus association. So
okay.
I'll have these two
gotcha.
Mythological characters that are under their names, but you'll never hear them, and with D you never do, and with Orpheus it's just once.
It's just once,
and that's very carefully timed.
So. When you think about this world between Charlie Manson and the madness of what happened there in the late 60s and 9/11 and also the kind of madness of our own lives, the contradictions of who we are as beings that can do many things we don't think we do or even things we don't admit that we do or did. When I finished this, I went back and started reading some Euripides. You got me to go back and start looking at some Greek stuff.
Good, yeah. It's probably better, actually.
No. You're a wonderful
but
writer.
But you have to read it in translation.
You're a wonderful writer. Just for our listeners, I think this is important just to think about what those plays, Euripides, what those Greeks have to say to us about us. That we don't, you know, that one of the tragedies of not having schools do that stuff anymore. It's not teaching that in high schools where they were taught. Not teaching that literature from that and to talk about who we are and the ancientness of the looking at the human heart and the dilemma of being a human being.
Well, I think what the Greek tragedists mostly did was present the most extreme and often the most extreme worst possibilities of human existence and human behavior, and just to see, like, you know, in this extreme worst case, how does it play out? And in spite of the fact that there's, you know, way more incest and sexual violence in our society than we want to know about or think about, there's really not that many people who marry their mothers or kill their fathers, especially not kill and eat their own children or kill their own children. The Medea story, I think, has got as Aristotle said, the idea of these things was to create a catharsis through pity and fear, and I think that concept still works. I mean, that was very much in my mind on this book, and to bring back the idea of awe, that that if I mean the Greeks thought of themselves as created beings, but I think not quite in the same way that Jews and Christians and Muslims do. Their gods were not so far away.
Right.
And there were a lot of them, you know, who sort of reflected the human world and their characteristics. But I think what the tragedies do with the kind of the awfulness and the popular word nowadays, the awesomeness of these acts that humans are capable of, it reminds you in the same way that you get in the book of Job, for example, of the inscrutable and apparently, from our point of view, amoral force of divine power. I think it's about that.
And I was thinking about, well, maybe I'm taking this too far.
Seems to be working out okay. So
when I think
you're making me think, you know, which is painful. But,
making Smart Bell think is a good thing. He thinks deeply as it is. The book is Color of Night. But when I think of All Souls Rising and some of the other books you've written, Master of the Crossroads and about the Haitian Revolution and this, there's this part of the human spirit that this speaks to about, I think, the contradiction of who we are. I mean, one of the things I got from this book, at least for me reading it, maybe it was because I was reading it at a dark moment because a great light was just snuffed out in Palestine and killed in Israel, blown away by people who live in the shadows of narrowness. Mm. And his name was Giuliano Meir, Kamas. Mother was an Israeli, was a Jewish. His father was Palestinian. He was a great writer and actor, ran this theater in the refugee camps. Amazing human being. And he was just murdered on Martin Luther King's, King's assassination. He was assassinated on the streets of Jenin. A lovely human being. But it made me think of the darkness that can pervade existence. You know, and that it's, these books sometimes talk about, this book specifically talks to me about how the darkness can take over. It doesn't mean clearly not the only force on the planet that we have to deal with, but it takes over.
I mean, I think you're, you know, heading toward why the Color of Night in a certain way is darker and more frightening than those Haitian books, which in aggregate are much bloodier. I mean, this book has maybe got, you know, 1,000 words total of explicit sex or violence. I mean, it mostly sort of, I mean, you don't remember it that way, but if you count. And then the other books is way more, but those books are about people trying to overcome a social situation, basically, so that they can be recognized as human and have freedom and certain rights, like same way, like a lot of things that have been happening in the south side of the Mediterranean lately seem in the beginning to have that go. This book is, the motives aren't the same. I mean, these are people who are already kind of at the top of the food chain, and you have to look for some other reason for them to behave as they do.
Right. And it also makes you think that as normal as people can seem on the outside, you could meet May.
She'd deal you blackjack hand and, you know, smile at you and you never know the difference.
Right. Might go to bed with you. Never know. But there's another piece lurking behind. And how one can do these kind of crazy, heinous things, but appear so normal to the world. Just kind of walk through it?
Well, Patty Hearst, I mean...
Patty Hearst.
I was listening to Patty Smith doing Hey Joe from what she must have recorded about 1976. And she has this little monologue at the front that was the kind of thing she was doing. And she would, it was sort of pre-rap. I mean, she would free associate, but in this very kind of vivid manner.
Uh-huh.
And she was... the Hendrix lyrics are there, and she was kind of rapping off stuff that was in the news, and I guess Patty Hearst's father had said, "Golly wampus," I can say that, but you know, oh my, 60 days ago, she was the nicest, most well-bred young woman you ever want to meet, and now she's out there with a gun in her hand. Which I'm sure he felt very deeply. And then that for Patti Smith becomes that she's picked up the Hendrix line and she's in the song.
Right, right, right.
But that's just what you're talking about.
It is. In May, the other one with the book, Erie.
Yes.
And you chose this the name, E-E-R-I-E.
Well, I took it. She's, her role is Eurydice. And I just was trying to like pull a contemporary name. And then she, to Laurel and May, she's as weird as they are, she's weird to them. In a couple, she's the chosen of Orpheus, which makes her very special because this guy, aside from any mythological dimension, there he's a rock star, you know.
Right.
So that's a big deal, you know. And so, in one sense, she has this privilege, and she's super beautiful, more so than they, although they're not bad. And the other thing is, she's like really a junkie, and they're not.
They're acid heads, if anything.
That's a little frightening to them. So Erie seemed to kind of encompass that.
I love that name. It also, because I thought about there's another edition of Erie, which is like the strange light in a cloud.
Yeah.
that you can see. The names in here, great. I love these names. Terrell, poor Terrell, the Vietnam vet. I find this other piece I just want to kind of play with, not the John Donne poem you threw in there, which was good.
Yeah.
You like Donne?
I like Donne. I'm sort of weak on Donne these days, but in college I spent a certain amount of time with Donne.
I can tell.
Another guy who, you know, conflated the ideas of his time with eroticism. Ideas of his time being more theological than philosophical.
I mean, you could tell from that May was very troubled when the one part in your book, I mean, that really just spoke to me when she was in the woods and then the way that she came down and frightened her brother and her brother's girlfriend in the truck. That was, said a lot about it. Well, I won't tell what that is because that's too good a part to read in the book. You got to read that one.
Tell them to go out and read it for themselves. But it's, I read that aloud sometimes, but it'd be a little long for right now.
Let me just read these two paragraphs.
Go for it.
As we close this thing out a little bit here. I just wanna, because it just says to me again some of the essence of the book. O's love for Erie brought her out of death the first time as my love for Laurel drove her deeper in. The way O loved Erie made it rain down water, and I love Laurel, I love Laurel, so the rain was blood. It was unknown for a goddess to surrender immortality, reduce herself to a world of mere living, to share with a mortal lover everything, down to death and dissolution. But I couldn't recall that night on the street the name of a single one who had done so, and Laurel's mortal lover, was long dead. To weaken oneself so.
Well, yeah, she's got a hard edge to her, this girl.
Very hard edge. Very hard edge. I mean, even when in her soft moments, she has a hard edge.
Yeah, well, she's scary. I mean, I'm not going to say she's not. I felt like I was made to think about this during a period when I mean, some people are not going to like this book, and there was a lot of discussions about that during the pre-publication period. And
with your publishers? Yeah.
So, yeah, I had to think about it. I had to think, you know, harder about what was positive about her. And that finally ended up saying in some piece of correspondence, she's beautiful like a snake is beautiful, you know, because a snake has got its single purpose and it does it real well, you know, and there's beauty in that.
You have snakes all through this book.
Yeah. my agent said it was more like a cat. My agent being more of a cat person than a snake person like me. She said, you don't blame a cat for killing mice, do you? It's in the nature of cats to do that.
That's right. So this is I was going to make a silly joke, but maybe it's not really real either. I was going to say Cormac McCarthy meets Madison Smart Bell, but you
it should be Cormac McCarthy meets Phyllis Diller.
Phyllis Diller. I mean, yeah. But you don't have to be anybody.
I can't be one of the people if it's that kind of pitch parody.
No. You're just an amazing writer on its own. I mean, every book you write.
Cormac McCarthy meets Joyce Carol. No. You want somebody really Mary Gateskill, somebody who's real. Amy Hempel. Cormac McCarthy meets Amy Hempel.
What I really meant by that is that this book is. I mean, you have this breadth of way of writing things that they can go in so many directions. I mean, I remember thinking about this and Ten Indians and Anything Goes. They're all very different. I mean, you have this way of kind of embodying a kind of literature when you have a story to tell and you can move deftly between them, which I think is not many writers do.
Well, I have a low boredom threshold. I don't like to do, I don't like to do the same thing twice.
This is phenomenal. The Color of Night by Madison Smart Bell. I think really it just grabbed me. I just sat down and I sat one evening and couldn't stop and went through it. So then you have to sit and think about it a little bit.
Yeah, you can read it twice. It'll stay with you.
It'll stay with you. Madison Smart Bell, thank you so much, my friend.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you here. The Color of Night by Madison Smart Bell. And we'll link to it on our website. So please read it. Stay with it. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show. Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM. The voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555.